clan, I vote for Grimstborith Oric as our new king.
That makes 3-3, Aragorn said in a low voice.
Oric nodded. It was Nardo's turn to speak then. Smoothing his beard with the flat of a hand, the chief of Durgrimst Nurlcarathen smiled at the assembly, a predatory gleam in his eyes.
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for myself as our new king. If you will have me, I promise to rid our country of the outlanders who have polluted it, and I promise to devote our gold and warriors to protecting our own people, and not the necks of elves, humans, and Urgals. This I swear upon mine family's honour.
4-3, Aragorn noted.
Aye, said Oric. I suppose it would have been too much to ask for Nardo to vote for anyone but himself.
Setting aside his knife and wood, Freowyn of Durgrimst Gedthral heaved his bulk halfway out of his chair, and keeping his gaze angled downward, said in his whispering baritone,
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimstborith Nardo as our new king.
Then he lowered himself back into his seat and resumed carving his raven, ignoring the stir of astonishment that swept through the room. Nardo's expression changed from pleased to smug.
Basil,
growled Oric, his scowl deepening. His chair creaked as he pressed his forearms down against the armrests, the tendons in his hands rigid with strain.
That false-faced traitor, he promised his vote to me.
Aragorn's stomach sank.
Why would he betray you?
He visits Sindri's temple twice a day. I should have known he would not go against Ganel's wishes. Ah, Ganel's been playing me this whole time.
At that moment, the attention of the clanmeet turned to Oric. Concealing his anger, Oric got to his feet and looked around the table at each of the other clan chiefs, and in his own language he said,
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for myself as our new king. If you will have me, I promise to bring our people gold and glory, and the freedom to live above the ground without fear of Galbatorix destroying our homes. This I swear upon mine family's honour.
5-4,
Aragorn said to Oric as he returned to his seat. And not in our favour. Oric grunted.
I can count, Aragorn.
Aragorn rested his elbows on his knees, his eyes darting from one dwarf to another.
The desire to act gnawed at him. How, he knew not, but with so much at stake, he felt that he ought to find a way to ensure Oric would become king, and thus that the dwarves would continue to aid the Varden in their struggle against the Empire. For all he tried, however, Aragorn could think of nothing to do but sit and wait.
The next dwarf to rise was Havard of Dorgrimst Fanghur. With his chin tucked against his breastbone, Havard pushed out his lips and tapped the table with the two fingers he still had on his right hand, appearing thoughtful.
Aragorn inched forward on his seat, his heart pounding. Will he uphold his bargain with Oric?
Aragorn wondered. Havard tapped the table once more, then slapped the stone with the flat of his hand. Lifting his chin, he said,
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimstborith Oric as our new king.
It gave Aragorn immense satisfaction to watch as Nardo's eyes widened, and then the dwarf gnashed his teeth together, a muscle in his cheek twitching.
Ha! Muttered Oric. That put a burr in his beard.
The only two clan chiefs who had yet to vote were Hridamar and Iorunan. Hridamar, the compact, muscular Grimstborith of the Urjad, appeared uneasy with the situation, while Iorunan, she of Durgrimst Vrenshurgen, the warwolves, traced the crescent-shaped scar on her left cheekbone with the tip of a pointed fingernail, and smiled like a self-satisfied cat. Aragorn held his breath as he waited to hear what the two of them would say.
If Eärendil votes for herself, he thought, and if Hridamar is still loyal to her, then the election will have to proceed to a second round. There's no reason for her to do that, however, other than to delay events, and so far as I know, she would not profit from a delay. She cannot hope to become queen at this point. Her name would be eliminated from consideration before the beginning of the second round, and I doubt she would be so foolish as to squander the power she has now, merely so she can boast to her grandchildren that she was once a candidate for the throne. But if Hridamar does part ways with her, then the vote will remain tied and we will continue on to a second round regardless.
Oh! If only I could scry into the future!
What if Auric loses? Should I seize control of the clan meet, then? I could seal the chamber so no one could enter or leave, and then... But no, that would be...
Eärendil interrupted Aragorn's thoughts by nodding at Hridamar, and then directing her heavy-lidded gaze toward Aragorn, which made him feel as if he were a prize ox she was examining, the rings of his mail hauberk clinking. Hridamar stood upright and said,
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimstborith Auric as our new king.
Aragorn's throat constricted. Her red lips curving with amusement, Eärendil rose from her chair with a sinuous motion, and in a low, husky voice said,
It seems it falls to me to decide the outcome of today's meet. I have listened most carefully to your arguments, Nardo, and your arguments, Auric. While you have both made points I agree with upon a wide range of subjects, the most important issue we must decide is whether to commit ourselves to the Vardan's campaign against the Empire. If theirs were merely a war between rival clans, it would not matter to me which side won. And I certainly would not consider sacrificing our warriors for the benefit of outlanders. However, this is not the case. Far from it. If Galbatorix emerges triumphant from this war, not even the Beor Mountains will protect us from his wrath. If our realm is to survive, we must see Galbatorix overthrown. Moreover, it strikes me that hiding in caves and tunnels, while others decide the fate of Alagazia, is unbecoming for a race as old and as powerful as ours. When the chronicles of this age are written, shall they say we fought alongside the humans and the elves as the heroes of old? Or that we sat cowering in our halls like frightened peasants while a battle raged outside our doors? I, for one, know mine answer.
Eärendil tossed back her hair, then said,
On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimstborith Auric as our new king.
The eldest of the five readers of law who stood against the circular wall stepped forward and struck the end of his polished staff against the stone floor and proclaimed,
All hail King Auric! The 43rd king of Trondheim, Farthen Dûr, and every Nurler above and below the Beor Mountains. All hail King Auric!
The clan meet roared, rising to their feet with a loud rustle of clothes and armour. His head swimming, Aragorn did likewise, aware that he was now in the presence of royalty. He glanced at Nardo, but the dwarf's face was a dead-eyed mask. The white-bearded reader of law struck his staff against the floor again.
Let the scribes record at once the clan meet's decision, and let the news be spread to every person throughout the realm. Heralds, inform the mages with their scrying mirrors of what has transpired here today. And then seek out the wardens of the mountain and tell them, Four beats upon the drum! Four beats, and swing your mallets as you have never swung them before in all your lives, for we have a new king! Four beats of such strength, Farthen Dûr itself shall ring with the news. Tell them this, I charge you. Go!
After the heralds departed, Oric pushed himself out of his chair and stood looking at the dwarves around him. His expression to Aragorn seemed somewhat dazed, as if he had not actually expected to win the crown.
"For this great responsibility," he said, "I thank you."
He paused, then continued,
"Mine only thought now is for the betterment of our nation, and I shall pursue that goal without faltering until the day I return to the stone."
Then the clan chiefs came forward one by one, and they knelt before Oric, and swore their fealty to him as his loyal subjects. When the time came for Nardo to pledge himself, the dwarf displayed nothing of his sentiments, but merely recited the phrases of the oath without inflection, the words dropping from his mouth like bars of lead. A palpable sense of relief rippled through the clan meet once he had finished. Upon the conclusion of the oath-giving, Oric decreed that his coronation would take place the following morning, and then he and his attendants retired to an adjacent chamber. There, Aragorn looked at Oric, and Oric looked at Aragorn, and neither made a sound until a broad smile appeared on Oric's face, and he broke out laughing, his cheeks turning red. Laughing with him, Aragorn grasped him by a forearm and embraced him. Oric's guards and advisers gathered around him, clapping Oric on the shoulder and congratulating him with hearty exclamations. Aragorn released Oric, saying,
"I didn't think Eorunn would side with us."
"Aye, I'm glad she did, but it complicates matters, it does,"
Oric grimaced.
"I suppose I shall have to reward her for her assistance with a place within my council at the very least."
"It may be for the best," said Aragorn, straining to make himself heard over the commotion. "If the Vrenshurgen are equal to their name, we shall have great need of them before we reach the gates of Urubain."
Oric started to answer, but then a long, low note of portentous volume reverberated throughout the floor and the ceiling and the air of the room, causing Aragorn's bones to vibrate with its force.
"Listen!"
cried Oric and raised a hand. The group fell silent. Four times in total the bass note sounded, shaking the room with each repetition as if a giant were pounding against the side of Trondheim. Afterward, Oric said,
"I never thought to hear the drums of Derva announce mine kingship."
"How large are the drums?"
asked Aragorn, awed.
"Close to 50 feet across, if memory serves."
It occurred to Aragorn that although the dwarves were the shortest of the races, they built the biggest structures in Alagaesia, which seemed odd to him. Perhaps, he thought, by making such enormous objects, they do not feel so small themselves. He almost mentioned his theory to Oric, but at the last moment decided that it might offend him, so he held his tongue. Closing ranks around him, Oric's attendants began to consult with him in Dwarvish, often speaking over one another in a loud tangle of voices, and Aragorn, who had been about to ask Oric another question, found himself relegated to a corner. He tried to wait patiently for a lull in the conversation, but after a few minutes it became plain the dwarves were not about to stop plying Oric with questions and advice, for such, he assumed, was the nature of their discourse. Therefore Aragorn said,
"Oric, Konungr,"
and he imbued the ancient language word for king with energy, that it would capture the attention of everyone present. The room fell silent, and Oric looked at Aragorn and lifted an eyebrow.
"Your Majesty, may I have your permission to withdraw? There is a certain matter I would like to attend to,"
if it is not already too late." Comprehension brightened Oryk's brown eyes.
"By all means, make haste. But you need not call me Majesty Aragorn, nor Sire, nor by any other title. We are friends and foster brothers, after all."
"We are, Your Majesty," Aragorn replied. "But for the time being, I believe it is only proper I should observe the same courtesies as everyone else. You are the king of your race now, and my own king as well, seeing as how I am a member of Dúr Grimston Jeetum, and that is not something I can ignore."
Oryk studied him for a moment, as if from a great distance, and then nodded and said,
"As you wish, Shadeslayer."
Aragorn bowed and left the room. Accompanied by his four guards, he bounded through the tunnels and up the stairs that led to the ground floor of Trondheim. Once they arrived at the southern branch of the four main hallways that divided the city mountain, Aragorn turned to Thrand, the captain of his guards, and said,
"I mean to run the rest of the way. Since you won't be able to keep pace with me, I suggest you stop when you reach the south gate of Trondheim and wait there for my return."
Thrand said,
"Arjitlam, please, you should not go alone. Cannot I convince you to slow yourself so we can accompany you? We may not be as fleet as the elves, but we can run from sunup to sundown, and in full armor, too."
"I appreciate your concern," said Aragorn. "But I would not tarry a minute longer, even if I knew there were assassins hiding behind every pillar. Farewell."
And with that, he dashed down the broad hallway, dodging around the dwarves who blocked his way.
Reunion.
It was nearly a mile from where Aragorn started to the south gate of Trondheim. He covered the distance in only a few minutes, his footsteps loud upon the stone floor. As he ran, he caught glimpses of the rich tapestries that hung above the arched entrances to the corridors on either side, and of the grotesque statues of beasts and monsters that lurked between the pillars of blood-red jasper that lined the vaulted avenue. The four-story high thoroughfare was so large, Aragorn had little difficulty evading the dwarves who populated it, although at one point a line of Nurl Carathan stepped in front of him, and he had no choice but to leap over the dwarves, who ducked, uttering startled exclamations. Aragorn savored their looks of astonishment as he sailed over them. With an easy, loping stride, Aragorn ran underneath the massive timber gate that protected the southern entrance to the city mountain, hearing the guards cry, "Hail, Arjitlam!" as he flew past. 20 yards beyond, for the gate was recessed into the base of Trondheim, he sped between the pair of giant gold griffins that stared with sightless eyes toward the horizon, and then emerged into the open. The air was cool and moist, and smelled like fresh-fallen rain. Though it was morning, grey twilight enveloped the flat disk of land that surrounded Trondheim, land upon which no grass grew, only moss and lichen, and the occasional patch of pungent toadstools. Above, Farthendur rose over 10 miles to a narrow opening, through which pale, indirect light entered the immense crater. Aragorn had difficulty grasping the scale of the mountain when he gazed upward. As he ran, he listened to the monotonous pattern of his breathing and to his light, quick footsteps. He was alone save for a curious bat that swooped overhead, emitting shrill squeaks. The tranquil mood that permeated the hollow mountain comforted him, freed him of his usual worries. He followed the cobblestone path that extended from Trondheim's south gate all the way to the 2 black 30-foot-high doors set into the southern base of Farthendur. As he drew to a halt, a pair of dwarves emerged from hidden guardrooms and hurried to open the doors, revealing the seemingly endless tunnel beyond. Aragorn continued forward. Marble pillars studded with rubies and amethysts lined the first 50 feet of the tunnel. Past them, the tunnel was bare and desolate, the smooth walls broken only by a single flameless lantern every 20 yards, and at infrequent intervals by a closed gate or door.
"I wonder where they lead," Aragorn thought, Then he imagined the miles of stone pressing down on him from overhead, and for a moment the tunnel seemed unbearably oppressive. He quickly pushed the image away. Halfway through the tunnel, Eragon felt her. "Saphira!" he shouted with both his mind and his voice, her name echoing off the stone walls with the force of a dozen yells.
"Eragon!"
An instant later, the faint thunder of a distant roar rolled toward him from the other end of the tunnel. Redoubling his speed, Eragon opened his mind to Saphira, removing every barrier around who he was so that they might join together without reservation. Like a flood of warm water, her consciousness rushed into him, even as his rushed into her. Eragon gasped and tripped and nearly fell. They enveloped each other within the folds of their thoughts, holding each other with an intimacy no physical embrace could replicate, allowing their identities to merge once again. Their greatest comfort was a simple one. They were no longer alone. To know that you were with one who cared for you, and who understood every fiber of your being, and who would not abandon you in even the most desperate of circumstances, that was the most precious relationship a person could have. And both Eragon and Saphira cherished it. It was not long before Eragon sighted Saphira, hurrying toward him as swiftly as she could without banging her head on the ceiling or scraping her wings against the walls. Her claws screeched on the stone floor as she slid to a stop in front of Eragon, fierce, sparkling, glorious. Crying out with joy, Eragon leaped upward and, ignoring her sharp scales, wrapped his arms around her neck and hugged her as tightly as he could, his feet dangling several inches in the air.
"Little one," said Saphira, her tone warm.
She lowered him to the floor, then snorted and said,
"Little one, unless you wish to choke me, you should loosen your arms."
"Sorry."
Grinning, he stepped back, then laughed and pressed his forehead against her snout and began to scratch behind both corners of her jaw. Saphira's low humming filled the tunnel.
"You're tired," he said.
"I have never flown so far, so fast. I stopped only once after I left the Varden, and I would not have stopped at all, except I became too thirsty to continue."
"Do you mean you haven't slept or eaten for 3 days?"
She blinked at him, concealing her brilliant sapphire eyes for an instant.
"You must be starving,"
Eragon exclaimed, worried. He looked her over for signs of injury. To his relief, he found none.
"I am tired," she admitted, "but not hungry, not yet. Once I have rested, then I will need to eat. Right now I do not think I could stomach so much as a rabbit. The earth is unsteady beneath me. I feel as if I am still flying."
If they had not been apart for so long, Eragon might have reproached her for being reckless, but as it was, he was touched and grateful that she had pushed herself.
"Thank you," he said. "I would have hated to wait another day for us to be together again."
"As would have I."
She closed her eyes and pressed her head against his hands as he continued to scratch behind her jaw.
"Besides, I could hardly be late for the coronation now, could I? Who did the clan meet?"
Before she could finish the question, Eragon sent her an image of Oryk.
"Ah,"
she sighed, her satisfaction flowing through him.
"He will make a fine king."
"I hope so."
"Is the star sapphire ready for me to mend?"
"If the dwarves have not already finished piecing it together, I'm sure they will have by tomorrow."
"That is good."
Cracking open an eyelid, she fixed him with her piercing gaze.
"Nasawada told me of what Aswelden Rakanowin attempted. Always you get into trouble when I am not with you."
His smile widened.
"And when you are?"
"I eat the trouble before it eats you."
so you say. What about when the Urgals ambushed us by Gilead and took me captive?
A plume of smoke escaped from between Sephira's fangs.
That does not count. I was smaller then, and not as experienced. It would not happen now. And you are not as helpless as you once were.
I've never been helpless, he protested. I just have powerful enemies.
For some reason, Sephira found his last statement enormously amusing. She started laughing deep within her chest, and soon Eragon was laughing as well. Neither of them was able to stop until Eragon was lying on his back, gasping for air, and Sephira was struggling to contain the darts of flame that kept shooting out of her nostrils. Then Sephira made a sound Eragon had never heard before, a strange, jumping growl, and he noticed the oddest feeling through their connection. Sephira made the sound again, then shook her head as if trying to rid herself of a swarm of flies.
Oh, dear,
she said.
I seem to have the hiccups.
Eragon's mouth dropped open. He held that pose for a moment. Then he doubled over, laughing so hard, tears streamed down his face. Every time he was about to recover, Sephira would hiccup, bobbing her head forward like a stork, and he would go off into convulsions again. At last he plugged his ears with his fingers and stared at the ceiling and recited the true names of every metal and stone he could remember. When he finished, he took a deep breath and stood.
Better?
Sephira asked. Her shoulders shook as another hiccup racked her. Eragon bit his tongue.
Better. Come on, let's go to Trondheim. You should have some water, that might help. And then you should sleep.
Cannot you cure hiccups with a spell?
Maybe, probably. But neither Brom nor Oromis taught me how.
Sephira grunted her understanding, and a hiccup followed an instant later. Biting his tongue even harder, Eragon stared at the tips of his boots.
Shall we?
Sephira extended her right foreleg in invitation. Eragon eagerly climbed up onto her back and settled into the saddle at the base of her neck. Together they continued through the tunnel toward Trondheim, both of them happy, and both of them sharing in each other's happiness.
Ascension. The drums of Derva sounded, summoning the dwarves of Trondheim to witness the coronation of their new king.
Normally,
Oric had told Eragon the previous night,
when the clan meet elects a king or queen, the Nurla begins their rule at once. But we do not hold the coronation for at least 3 months, so that all who wish to attend the ceremony may have time to place their affairs in order and to travel to Farthendur from even the most distant parts of our realm. It is not often we crown a monarch, so when we do, it is our custom to make much of the event, with weeks of feasting and song, and with games of wit and strength, and contests of skill at forging, carving, and other forms of art. However, these are hardly normal times.
Eragon stood next to Sephira, just outside the central chamber of Trondheim, listening to the pounding of the giant drums. On either side of the mile-long hall, hundreds of dwarves crowded the archways of each level, peering at Eragon and Sephira with dark, gleaming eyes. Sephira's barbed tongue rasped against her scales as she licked her chops, which she had been doing ever since she finished devouring 5 full-grown sheep earlier that morning. Then she lifted her left foreleg and rubbed her muzzle against it. The smell of burnt wool clung to her.
"Stop fidgeting," said Eragon. "They're looking at us."
A soft growl emanated from Sephira.
"I can't help it. I have wool stuck between my teeth. Now I remember why I hate eating sheep. Horrible, fluffy things that give me hairballs and indigestion.
I'll help you clean your teeth when we are finished here. Just hold still until then. Did Blodgarm pack any fireweed in the saddlebags? That would settle your stomach.
I don't know.
Aragorn thought for a moment. If not, I'll ask Oryk if the dwarves have any stored in Trondheim. We ought to...
He cut himself off, as the final note from the drums faded into silence.
The crowd shifted, and he heard the soft rustle of clothes and the occasional phrase of murmured dwarvish. A fanfare of dozens of trumpets rang forth, filling the city mountain with its rousing call, and somewhere a choir of dwarves began to chant. The music made Aragorn's scalp tingle and prickle, and his blood flow faster, as if he were about to embark upon a hunt. Saphira whipped her tail from side to side, and he knew she felt the same.
Here we go, he thought.
As one, he and Saphira advanced into the central chamber of the city mountain, and took their place among the ring of clan chiefs, guild leaders, and other notables, who girded the vast, towering room. In the center of the chamber rested the reconstructed Star Sapphire, encased within a framework of wooden scaffolding. An hour before the coronation, Skeg had sent a message to Aragorn and Saphira, telling them that he and his team of artisans had just finished fitting together the last fragments of the gem, and that Isidar Mithrim was ready for Saphira to make whole once more. The black granite throne of the dwarves had been carried from its customary resting place underneath Trondheim and placed upon a raised dais next to the Star Sapphire. Facing the eastern branch of the four main hallways that divided Trondheim, east because it was the direction of the rising sun, and that symbolized the dawning of a new age. Thousands of dwarf warriors clad in burnished mail armor stood at attention in two large blocks before the throne, as well as in double rows along either side of the eastern hallway, all the way to Trondheim's eastern gate, a mile away. Many of the warriors carried spears mounted with pennants that bore curious designs. Hvedra, Oryk's wife, stood at the forefront of the congregation. After the clanmeet had banished Grimstborith Vermund, Oryk had sent for her in anticipation of becoming king. She had arrived in Trondheim only that morning. For half an hour the trumpets played and the unseen choir sang, as step by deliberate step, Oryk walked from the eastern gate to the center of Trondheim. His beard was brushed and curled, and he wore buskins of the finest polished leather with silver spurs mounted upon the heels, grey wool leggings, a shirt of purple silk that shimmered in the lantern light, and over his shirt a mail hauberk, each link of which was wrought of pure white gold. A long ermine-trimmed cloak, embroidered with the insignia of Durgrimstin Jetum, flowed over Oryk's shoulders and onto the floor behind him. Volund, the warhammer that Corgan, first king of the dwarves, had forged, hung at Oryk's waist from a wide, ruby-studded belt. Because of his lavish raiment and his magnificent armor, Oryk seemed to glow from within. To look at him dazzled Aragorn's eyes. 12 dwarf children followed Oryk, 6 male and 6 female, or so Aragorn assumed, based upon the cut of their hair. The children were garbed in tunics of red and brown and gold, and they each carried in their cupped hands a polished orb 6 inches across, every orb a different species of stone. As Oryk entered the center of the city mountain, the chamber dimmed, and a pattern of dappled shadows appeared on everything within. Confused, Aragorn glanced upward, and was astonished to behold pink rose petals drifting downward from the top of Trondheim. Like soft, thick snowflakes, the velvety petals settled upon the heads and shoulders of those in attendance, and also upon the floor, suffusing the air with their sweet fragrance. The trumpets and the choir fell silent, as Oryk knelt on one knee before the black throne, and bowed his head. Behind him the 12 children stopped and stood motionless. Aragorn placed his hand on Saphira's warm side, sharing his concern and excitement with her. He had no idea what would happen next,
for Oryk had refused to describe the ceremony past that point. Then Ganel, clan chief of Durgrimst Kwan, stepped forward, breaking the ring of people around the chamber, and walked to stand on the right-hand side of the throne. The heavy-shouldered dwarf was apparelled in sumptuous red robes, the borders of which gleamed with runes outlined with metal thread. In one hand, Ganel bore a tall staff with a clear, pointed crystal mounted on the top. Lifting the staff over his head with both hands, Ganel brought it down upon the stone floor with a resounding crack.
"Huatum ilskilskadumun!"
he exclaimed. He continued to speak in the tongue of the dwarves for some minutes, and Aragorn listened without comprehending, for his translator was not with him. But then the tenor of Ganel's voice shifted, and Aragorn recognized his words as belonging to the ancient language, and he realized Ganel was weaving a spell, although it was a spell unlike any Aragorn was familiar with. Instead of directing the incantation at an object or an element of the world around them, the priest said in the language of mystery and power,
"Guntera, creator of the heavens and the earth and the boundless sea, hear now the cry of your faithful servant. We thank you for your magnanimity. Our race flourishes. This and every year we have offered to you the finest rams of our flocks, and also flagons of spiced mead and a portion of our harvests of fruits and vegetables and grain. Your temples are the richest in the land, and none may hope to compete with the glory that is yours. O mighty Guntera, king of the gods, hear now mine plea, and grant me this request. Time is for us to name a mortal ruler of our earthly affairs. Will you deign to bestow your blessing upon Oryk, Thrifk's son, and to crown him in the tradition of his predecessors?"
At first Aragorn thought Ganel's request would go unanswered, for he felt no surge of magic from the dwarf when he finished speaking. However, Saphira nudged him then and said,
"Look!"
Aragorn followed her gaze, and 30 feet above saw a disturbance among the tumbling petals, a gap, a void, where the petals would not fall, as if an invisible object occupied the space. The disturbance spread, extending all the way to the floor, and the void outlined by the petals assumed the shape of a creature with arms and legs like a dwarf, or a man, or an elf, or an Urgle, but of different proportions than any race Aragorn had knowledge of. The head was nearly the width of the shoulders, the massive arms hung below the knees, and while the torso was bulky, the legs were short and crooked. Thin, needle-sharp rays of watery light radiated outward from the shape, and there appeared the nebulous image of a gigantic, shaggy-haired male figure, of the form the petals had traced. The god, if god he was, wore nothing but a knotted loincloth. His face was dark and heavy and seemed to contain equal amounts of cruelty and kindness, as if he might veer between the extremes of both without warning. As he noticed those details, Aragorn also became aware of the presence of a strange, far-reaching consciousness within the chamber, a consciousness of unreadable thoughts and unfathomable depths, a consciousness that flashed and growled and billowed in unexpected directions like a summer thunderstorm. Aragorn quickly sequestered his mind from the touch of the other. His skin prickled and a cold shiver ran down him. He did not know what he had felt, but fear gripped him, and he looked at Saphira for comfort. She was staring at the figure, her blue cat eyes sparkling with unusual intensity. With a single motion the dwarves sank to their knees. The god spoke then, and his voice sounded like the grinding of boulders and the sweep of the wind over barren mountain peaks and the slap of waves against a stony shore. He spoke in dwarvish, and though Aragorn knew not what was said,
he shrank from the power of the god's speech. 3 times the god questioned Oryk, and 3 times Oryk replied, his own voice faint in comparison. Apparently pleased with Oryk's answers, the apparition extended his glowing arms and placed his 4 fingers on either side of Oryk's bare head. The air between the god's fingers rippled, and upon Oryk's brow materialized the gem-encrusted helm of gold that Hrothgar had worn. The god slapped his belly and uttered a booming chuckle, and then faded into oblivion. The rose petals resumed their fall uninterrupted.
"Unquaroth Gunterra,"
Ganel proclaimed. Loud and brassy, the trumpets blared. Rising from his knee, Oryk ascended the dais, turned to face the assembly, and then he sank into the hard black throne.
"Narl Grimstens Borith Oryk!"
the dwarves shouted, and struck their shields with their axes and their spears, and stamped the floor with their feet.
"Narl Grimstens Borith Oryk! Narl Grimstens Borith Oryk!"
"All hail, King Oryk!"
cried Aragorn. Arching her neck, Saphira roared her tribute and released a jet of flame over the heads of the dwarves, incinerating a swath of rose petals. Aragorn's eyes watered as a blast of heat washed over him. Then Ganel knelt before Oryk and spoke some more in dwarvish. When he finished, Oryk touched him upon the crown of his head, and then Ganel returned to his place at the edge of the chamber. Nardo approached the throne and said many of the same things, and after him so did Manandrath, and Hadfala, and all the other clan chiefs, with the sole exception of Grimstborith Vermund, who had been banned from the coronation.
"They must be pledging themselves to Oryk's service,"
Aragorn said to Saphira.
"Did not they already give him their word?"
"Aye, but not in public."
Aragorn watched Thordris walk toward the throne before saying,
"Saphira, what do you think we just saw? Could that really have been Gunterra, or was it an illusion? His mind seemed real enough, and I do not know how one might fake that, but..."
"It may have been an illusion," she said. "The dwarves' gods have never helped them upon the field of battle, nor in any other endeavor I am aware of. Nor do I believe that a true god would come running at Ganel's summons like a trained hound. I would not, and should not a god be greater than a dragon? But then there are many inexplicable things in Alagasia. It is possible we have seen a shade from a long-forgotten age, a pale remnant of what once was, that continues to haunt the land, longing for the return of its power. Who can know for sure?"
Once the final clan chief had presented himself to Oryk, the guild leaders did the same, and then Oryk gestured toward Aragorn. With a slow, measured pace, Aragorn walked forward between the rows of dwarf warriors until he reached the base of the throne, where he knelt. And as a member of Dur Grimstin Jeetum, acknowledged Oryk as his king, and swore to serve and protect him. Then, acting as Nasuada's emissary, Aragorn congratulated Oryk on behalf of Nasuada and the Varden, and promised him the Varden's friendship. Others went to speak with Oryk as Aragorn withdrew, a seemingly endless train of dwarves eager to demonstrate their loyalty to their new king. The procession continued for hours, and then the gift-giving began. Each of the dwarves brought Oryk an offering from their clan or their guild. A goblet of gold filled to the brim with rubies and diamonds, a corselet of enchanted mail that no blade could pierce, a tapestry 20 feet long, woven of the soft wool the dwarves combed from the beards of the Feldunost goats, a tablet of agate, inscribed with the names of every one of Oryk's ancestors, a curved dagger ground from the tooth of a dragon, and many other treasures. In exchange, Oryk presented the dwarves with rings as tokens of his gratitude. Aragorn and Saphira were the last to go before Oryk. Once again kneeling at the base of the dais, Aragorn drew from his tunic the gold armband he had begged from the dwarves the previous night.
He held it up toward Oric, saying, "Here is my gift, King Oric. I did not make the armlet, but I have set on it spells to protect you. So long as you wear it, you need fear no poison. If an assassin tries to hit or stab you or throw any kind of object at you, the weapon will miss. The band will even shield you from most hostile magic. And it has other properties as well, which you may find of use if your life is in danger." Inclining his head, Oric accepted the band from Aragorn and said,
"Your gift is most appreciated, Aragorn Shadeslayer."
In full view of everyone, Oric slid the band onto his left arm. Saphira spoke next, projecting her thoughts to everyone who was watching.
"My gift is this, Oric."
She walked past the throne, her claws clacking against the floor, and reared up and placed her forefeet upon the edge of the scaffolding around the star sapphire. The stout wood beams creaked under her weight, but held. Minutes passed, and nothing happened, but Saphira remained where she was, gazing at the huge gemstone. The dwarves watched her, never blinking, hardly breathing.
"Are you sure you can do this?"
Aragorn asked, reluctant to break her concentration.
"I don't know. The few times I'd used magic before, I didn't pause to consider whether I was casting a spell or not. I just willed the world to change, and it did. It was not a deliberate process. I suppose I will have to wait until the moment feels right for me to mend Isidar Mithrim."
"Let me help. Let me work a spell through you."
"No, little one. This is my task, not yours."
A single voice, low and clear, wafted across the chamber, singing a slow, wistful melody. One by one, the other members of the hidden dwarf choir joined in the song, filling Trondheim with the plaintive beauty of their music. Aragorn was going to ask for them to be silent, but Saphira said,
"It's all right. Leave them alone."
Although he did not understand what the choir sang, Aragorn could tell from the tone of the music that it was a lamentation for things that had been and were no more, such as the star sapphire. As the song built toward its conclusion, he found himself thinking of his lost life in Palancar Valley, and tears welled in his eyes. To his surprise, he sensed a similar strain of pensive melancholy from Saphira. Neither sorrow nor regret was a normal part of her personality, so he wondered at it, and would have questioned her, except that he also sensed a stirring of something deep within her, like the awakening of some ancient part of her being. The song ended on a long, wavering note, and as it faded into oblivion, a surge of energy rushed through Saphira. So much energy, Aragorn gasped at its magnitude, and she bent and touched the star sapphire with the tip of her snout. The branching cracks within the giant gemstone flared bright as bolts of lightning, and then the scaffolding shattered and fell to the floor, revealing Isidar Mithrim whole and sound again. But not quite the same. The colour of the jewel was a deeper, richer shade of red than before, and the innermost petals of the rose were shot through with streaks of dusky gold. The dwarves stared in wonder at Isidar Mithrim. Then they leaped to their feet, cheering and applauding Saphira with such enthusiasm it sounded like the pounding roar of a waterfall. She dipped her head toward the crowd, and then walked back to Aragorn, crushing rose petals under her feet.
"Thank you,"
she said to him.
"For what?"
"For helping me. It was your emotions that showed me the way. Without them, I might have stayed there for weeks before I felt inspired to fix Isidar Mithrim."
Lifting his arms, Oric quieted the crowd, and then he said,
"On behalf of our entire race, I thank you for your gift, Saphira. Today you have restored the pride of our realm, and we shall not forget your deed. Let it not be said that Nerlin are an ungrateful lot. From now until the end of time, Your name shall be recited at the winter festivals, along with the lists of master makers. And when Isidar Mithrim is returned to its setting at the peak of Tronchim, your name will be engraved in the collar surrounding the star rose, along with that of Duroc Ornthrond, who first gave shape to the jewel.
To both Aragorn and Saphira, Oryk said,
Once again you have demonstrated your friendship to mine people. It pleases me that by your actions you have vindicated my foster father's decision to adopt you into Durgrimst Ingitum.
After the conclusion of the multitude of rituals that followed the coronation, and after Aragorn had helped remove the wool caught between Saphira's teeth, a slippery, slimy, smelly task that left him needing a bath, the two of them attended the banquet held in Oryk's honour. The feasting was loud and boisterous, and lasted long into the night. Jugglers and acrobats entertained the guests, as well as a troupe of actors, who performed a play called Ash Sartos Vrenet Rak Balmung, Grimstens Boreth Rak Kvisagor, which Hunfast told Aragorn meant the saga of King Balmung of Kvisagor. When the celebrations had died down some, and most of the dwarves were deep in their cups, Aragorn leaned toward Oryk, who sat at the head of the stone table, and said, Your Majesty. Oryk waved a hand.
I won't have you calling me Your Majesty all the time, Aragorn. It won't do. Unless the occasion demands it, use my name as you always have. That's an order.
He reached for his goblet, but missed and nearly knocked the container over. He laughed. Smiling, Aragorn said,
Oryk, I have to ask. Was that really Gunterra who crowned you?
Oryk's chin sank to his chest, and he fingered the stem of the goblet, his expression growing serious.
It was as close to Gunterra as we are ever likely to see on this earth. Does that answer your question, Aragorn?
I think so. Does he always answer when called upon? Has he ever refused to crown one of your rulers?
The gap between Oryk's eyebrows narrowed.
Have you ever heard of the heretic kings and the heretic queens before?
Aragorn shook his head.
They are Nerlin who failed to secure Gunterra's blessing as our next ruler, and yet who nevertheless insisted upon taking the throne.
Oryk's mouth twisted.
Without exception, their reigns were short and unhappy ones.
A band seemed to tighten around Aragorn's chest.
So even though the clanmeet elected you their leader, if Gunterra had failed to crown you, you would not be king now.
That, or I would be king of a nation at war with itself?
Oryk shrugged.
I was not overly worried about the possibility. With the Varden in the midst of invading the Empire, only a madman would risk tearing our country apart, merely to deny me the throne. And while Gunterra is many things, he is not mad.
But you did not know for certain, said Aragorn.
Oryk shook his head.
Not until he placed the helm upon mine head.
Words of Wisdom.
Sorry,
said Aragorn as he bumped the basin. Nasuada frowned, her face shrinking and elongating as a row of ripples ran through the water in the basin.
What for? She asked. I should think congratulations are in order. You have accomplished everything I sent you to do, and more. No, I...
Aragorn stopped as he realized she could not see the disturbance in the water. The spell was designed so that Nasuada's mirror would provide her with an unobstructed view of him and Saphira, not the objects they were gazing at.
I struck the basin with my hand, that is all. Oh, in that case, let me formally congratulate you, Aragorn, by ensuring Oric became king, even if it was by getting myself attacked.
Nasawada smiled.
Yes, even if it was by getting yourself attacked, you have preserved our alliance with the dwarves, and that might mean the difference between victory and defeat. The question now becomes, how long until the rest of the dwarves' army will be able to join us?
Oric has already ordered the warriors to ready themselves for departure, said Aragorn. It will probably take the clans a few days to muster their forces, but once they do, they'll march immediately.
It's a good thing, too. We can use their assistance as soon as possible. Which reminds me, when can we expect you to return? 3 days? 4 days?
Saphira shuffled her wings, her breath hot on the back of Aragorn's neck. Aragorn glanced at her, and then, choosing his words with care, he said,
That depends. Do you remember what we discussed before I left?
Nasawada pursed her lips.
Of course I do, Aragorn.
She
looked off to the side of the image and listened as a man addressed her, his voice an unintelligible murmur to Aragorn and Saphira. Returning her attention to them, Nasawada said,
Captain Edric's company has just returned. They appear to have suffered heavy casualties, but our watchmen say that Roran survived.
Was he injured?
Asked Aragorn.
I'll let you know once I find out. I would not worry too much, though. Roran has the luck of...
Once again, the voice of an unseen person distracted Nasawada, and she stepped out of view. Aragorn fidgeted while he waited.
My apologies, said Nasawada, her visage reappearing in the basin. We are closing in on Feinster, and we are having to fight off marauding groups of soldiers Lady Lorana sends from the city to harass us. Aragorn, Saphira, we need you for this battle. If the people of Feinster see only men, dwarves and urgles gathered outside their walls, they may believe they have a chance of holding the city, and they will fight all the harder because of it. They can't hold Feinster, of course, but they have yet to realize that. If they see a dragon and rider leading the charges against them, however, they will lose the will to fight.
But...
Nasawada raised her hand, cutting him off.
There are other reasons for you to return as well. Because of my wounds from the trial of the Long Knives, I cannot ride into battle with the Varden as I have before. I need you to take my place, Aragorn, in order to see that my commands are carried out as I intend, and also to prop up the spirits of our warriors. What's more, rumors of your absence are already coursing through the camp, despite our best efforts to the contrary. If Murtagh and Thorn attack us directly as a result, or if Galbatorix sends them to reinforce Feinster, well, even with the elves by our sides, I doubt we could withstand them. I'm sorry, Aragorn, but I cannot allow you to return to Ellesmere right now. It's too dangerous.
Pressing his hands against the edge of the cold stone table upon which the basin rested, Aragorn said,
Nasawada, please. If not now, then when?
Soon. You must be patient.
Soon.
Aragorn drew a deep breath, tightening his grip on the table.
How soon, exactly?
Nasawada frowned at him.
You cannot expect me to know that. First we must take Feinster, and then we must secure the countryside, and then...
And then you intend to march on Bellatona or Drasleona, and then to Urubane, said Aragorn.
Nasawada attempted to reply, but he did not allow her the opportunity. And the closer you get to Galbatorix, the likelier it will be that Murtagh and Thorn will attack you, or even the king himself, and you will be ever more reluctant to let us go.
Nasawada, Saphira and I do not have the skill, the knowledge, nor the strength to kill Galbatorix. You know that. Galbatorix could end this war at any time if he was willing to leave his castle and confront the Varden directly. We have to talk with our teachers again. They can tell us where Galbatorix's power is coming from, and they might be able to show us a trick or two that will allow us to defeat him.
Nasawada gazed downward, studying her hands.
Thorn and Murtagh could destroy us while you are gone.
And if we do not go,
Galbatorix will destroy us when we reach Urabane. Could you wait a few days before you attack, Feinster?
We could, but every day we camp outside the city will cost us lives.